From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. Popular literature in the United States has drawn a good deal lately on the myths and adventures associated with a much earlier kind of writing. The sort of thing you find, for instance, in legends about King Arthur, or in works like The Faerie Queen, a poem by Edmund Spenser, the 16th century English poet. But Spenser is perhaps more modern than you may think. Here's John Wall, a professor at North Carolina State University in Raleigh and a scholar at the National Humanities Center.
Well, The Faerie Queen is an adventure story. To start off, it's a story about knights and ladies and dragons, and we're all interested in their movies right now.
The good guys and the bad guys.
Well, the...
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. Popular literature in the United States has drawn a good deal lately on the myths and adventures associated with a much earlier kind of writing. The sort of thing you find, for instance, in legends about King Arthur, or in works like The Faerie Queen, a poem by Edmund Spenser, the 16th century English poet. But Spenser is perhaps more modern than you may think. Here's John Wall, a professor at North Carolina State University in Raleigh and a scholar at the National Humanities Center.
Well, The Faerie Queen is an adventure story. To start off, it's a story about knights and ladies and dragons, and we're all interested in their movies right now.
The good guys and the bad guys.
Well, Spenser is far more complicated than that. not something so obviously black and white, let's say, as Raiders of the Lost Ark, but... We've had, in recent years, we've had Steinbeck's version of the Arthur material published. We've had any number of novels that draw on the Arthurian material. Just recently, we've had the boom of interest in Tolkien and his Hobbit stories, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Certainly Spenser is not the only other person who uses all this material, but Spenser is in some ways there are lots of Arthurian narratives in the Middle Ages, and the most famous is Malory's Death of Arthur, which is the basis for Camelot and the basis for all these things. But Spenser is doing something with that material. Why should somebody read it? Well, it's you know, you might as well read the original. I mean, you might as well read the best one. You might as well read something that is a work in which all of this material, which is fascinating in and of itself, is brought to bear on the specific political realities in which Spenser finds himself.
Well, what's it about? What's his point in the Faerie Queen?
Well, he said early on that in a letter to Sir Walter Raleigh, the patron Englishman of this state and the settler of America, that the purpose of the Faerie Queen was to fashion a gentleman in the virtues that a gentleman should have. A gentleman, a noble person, not just a man, but all noble people, men and women, in the virtues that make up true nobility.
So he's trying to teach you something, merely entertain you.
It is blatantly a didactic book, but in the best sense of being didactic, it is Spenser's compatriot Sir Philip Sidney said that literature is the best teacher because it teaches, delights, and moves, and it moves because it delights. The Faerie Queen is full of mythical landscapes and monsters and all the kinds of things that people who play Dungeons and Dragons and read Tolkien. Spenser does it, and he gives you the full aura, the language. Once you get beyond the initial unfamiliarity with the language adds to that sense of the marvelous.
Who are some of the memorable characters?
Well, in Book One, we have the Red Cross Knight who acts out the legend of St. George. He slays the dragon, and later on we have knights who are women. We have Britomart in who's a woman and a knight. We have beautiful ladies. We have monstrous ladies. We have monstrous human beings. We have... it has everything. the difference between the way Spencer handles the Arthurian material and the way in which more contemporary writers, and I can't speak for all contemporary writers and movie makers, but it seems to me that there's a very strong element of escapism in modern Arthurian material. Spencer is the antithesis of that. Spencer is using the Arthurian material as a vocabulary for talking about his own world, talking about the otherness of the Arthurian world. Is not an escape. It's not a, in Spencer, it's not a place that you can go to get away from your own world, but it's a way of talking about the possibilities that exist in your own world that you perhaps hadn't thought about. It may in fact be, if you take the Fairy Queen seriously, it may in fact be that for Spencer that the events in the life of Queen Elizabeth, to whom the whole poem is addressed and who in some sense is represented in the poem as the Fairy Queen, that the poem is about what it's possible for her reign in England to achieve. It's possible to achieve a kind of greatness that if one in fact, if people are in fact learn how to be truly noble in the best sense of the word noble, it is possible to achieve enormous greatness. Is it possible to achieve the building up of the kingdom and the building up of the kingdom of charity, the building up of the kingdom of love, which is what the Fairy Queen is all about? It's supposed to end in a wedding, although Spencer never got that far with it. The building up of the kingdom of love here is, in Spencer's terms, the way to the full kingdom of love after now, after this world. Spencer is accepts a Christian perspective on history, which is that God is involved in human life in a way that points toward a fulfillment of his promises in an age to come. And for Spencer, this world is the arena in which one gets involved in what God is doing, and one becomes a citizen of that world to come by being an active citizen of this one, and by participating in what God is doing in this world. And for Spencer, participating in the building up of Gloriana's court, the country, and the Fairy Queen, is the way to go about that.
Well, he's obviously got his eye on another world. How does that affect the world that we live in?
Well, the kind of split that we have politically right now between people who feel that government should be involved in the lives of people, presumably for the betterment of society, and that government should stay out of people's lives. And to the extent to which those kinds of issues get dealt with in religious terms, they come out in a split between whether a God is still involved in human history and calls people at every level of their lives, both private and personal and societal and governmental, to be involved in charitable activity and in promoting the reign of justice or whatever, and whether or not it's all beyond.
John Wall is a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of English at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. At the center, Professor Wall is working on a project entitled The Poetics of Persuasion in the English Renaissance. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with Soundings. The question of how cultures and peoples evolve, flourish, or fail is central to archaeology, anthropology, and classical studies. But the important connections between ancient societies and present-day life are as elusive as they are fascinating. Marie-Henriette Gates, a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center, specializes in the archaeology of the Near East. She's the assistant director of an archaeological excavation in southeastern Turkey.
If one wants to investigate the sources for our own culture, certainly everything is stemming from the ancient Near East. Also, I think it's a very good perspective to take that our civilizations are not the most advanced, stemming from something very primitive. But that on the contrary, even 5,000 years ago, there were remarkably developed urban centers and technologically very mature cultures in these areas. And I think it gives one a very good vision of one's own place in in the cultural spectrum.
What is it that archaeologists learn about human nature, about the way people behave, religion, for instance, that carries across this span of time that you deal with?
On the whole, we in the United States are not getting lessons from any of this, but we can certainly understand quite readily what are the facets which are forming reactions of people in this area today, because they are really very much the descendants, frequently, of these older traditions. One thing that I always stress is the fact that the geographical boundaries of countries today are almost identical to those which existed in the ancient world. And this is not by chance. One can find this, that is, that the topography and the climate and the rivers flowing through, all of this is dictating very precisely the limits of certain cultures and certain areas, such that Iraq today covers an area which corresponds exactly to ancient Mesopotamia and Assyria. So these are, and the people who the people who are living in these places today, in fact, are following modes of life which are in many respects quite similar to what was existing beforehand. Mm-hmm. These villages in the Near East today are continuing an existence which is very much the same as 3,000 years ago, and they too want things to have, they want to have part of all of this modernism, but I think that outside the advent of plastic, perhaps things have not changed very much in any of these countries, and I think for many of them it gives them a much happier, much quieter, much more peaceful existence. They expect things to be the way these things were for their ancestors. Their expectations are fewer, they lead perhaps much much more physically tiring lives. They probably suffer a great deal more than we do. On the other hand, their expectations are not boundless, and as a result they can fulfill them readily by continuing an existence much as they have had before. They want to have a new watch, or they all would like to have a car, but this is not the summum of their existence.
Can you tell me about the dig that you participated in, sponsored by Bryn Mawr College and the University of North Carolina?
It is in an area in the southeast of Turkey, which sits around the Euphrates, and which is going to be flooded within 8 years or so. The Turks are building two large hydroelectric dams. And as a result of this, they have invited archaeologists, both Turks and foreigners, to come and do salvage work in this area. It is an area which is culturally very important for ancient times and all the way through to medieval, because it is at this northern extension of the Euphrates. It is rather closely tied culturally with the areas to the south, Syria and into Mesopotamia.
With reference to the dig that you participated in Turkey, how do you determine the importance of a dig and its content?
Well, first you have, in this case, it was because of this peculiar incidence of the flooding of this area. It is an area we would not necessarily have picked, although certainly it's one that answers the specific interests of both my colleague Dick Ellis and of mine. On the other hand, you usually choose a site only after intensive surveying, so that you have a fairly good idea of what is going to be there. And if you are particularly interested in one period or one interrelationship between one area or another, you will pick a site that you think will give you information on that. Now, our site we picked because of from the survey material, that the survey that had been done on that site by a Turkish team, and from two brief surveys which we had done on the site, it seemed to be very promising for the Bronze Age. Now, it turns out from this, the soundings that we made this summer, that perhaps the most interesting phase on the mound is at the very bottom of the mound, and is this Neolithic that is quite early period, which is very well represented there, and which is not well represented in any other site in the area that's being excavated presently. One problem with starting excavations is that you are not well aware of what is there. You have made only a survey by picking up sherds that are on the top of the mound, that is, that have eroded, that have been laid bare by erosion, or that have percolated up through animal burrows. And frequently things are either overrepresented on the surface or are not represented at all. Another thing is that since this area has been very little investigated, we have rather few sites that are firmly dated that we can compare our material to and have good firm dates. So much of the pottery which we had thought was Iron Age, for instance, in surveying, has turned out to be medieval. And we thought originally that there was very little medieval on this mound, and in fact there seems to be a very strong, very thick accumulation of just that.
Mm-hmm. Marie Henriette, what do people need to know about archaeology? What is the average person who's generally interested, who would say, well, I'll read that newspaper article about a dig, that kind of thing. What is it that they need to know? Is there?
They need to know, perhaps, that archaeology is not always sensational.
Mm-hmm. Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yes, that, in fact, it's fortunately not subject to that sort of excitement, although this is not always the case. There have certainly been cases there. Archaeologists have engaged in all sorts of very exciting adventures. In times of war, archaeologists are frequently taken as spies for various countries because they tend to know the terrain very well, which is yet another reason why governments will look askance at archaeologists, because they set up networks and just from knowing people, which are can be subject to misinterpretation. They should, the public at large should know that it's a very painstaking science, that it is not something that anyone can do, and anyone can go dig up an Indian mound in their backyard, because it is something that must be done with constant record keeping. Something else that people should know about archaeology, and this is actually as a side plea against the antiquities trade, objects, because they are old, are frequently given an enormous monetary value. People will buy things because they are old, and consequently sometimes quite precious and or quite beautiful. However, these objects are all tokens of a time period or a civilization or a culture. Once they are removed from their context, they lose all of their value. It's a moral question, but it is also to be a plea to be addressed to potential buyers that they simply should not buy these things.
Marie Henriette Gates, a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center, is a professor of classics at the University of North Carolina. She's assistant director of an archaeological excavation in southeastern Turkey. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. V.S. Naipaul's novel, A Bend in the River, published in 1979, has received both critical and popular acclaim. Here are some comments about the book from Paul Murphy, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of history at the University of Minnesota. Having lived in Nigeria and traveled in East Africa, Professor Murphy knows the cultural and geographical contrasts central to V.S. Naipaul's novel, A Bend in the River. Is the book important as social history?
Well, I think quite. I think to the extent that we have in the leading character in this book, a person who is in many ways sort of the prototype refugee individual, the man who is really no longer an Indian in the sense that he can possibly ever go back to that set of roots as far as his foundation is concerned, who at the same time is not ever going to be an African. He is obviously going to be living in a hostile culture or a foreign culture, who then has to some way decide where he fits, where he goes, what he does within that circumstance to find some sort of, you know, human fulfillment, to find some sort of meaning in his life generally.
And how does A Bend in the River answer that question for him?
I think the man in the novel is himself, at least as Naipaul treats him, a somewhat introspective person, in that he keeps asking himself questions about where do I fit? Why is it that I cannot make this transition? Do I want to make this transition? Do I play a role here which is important and which will ever lead to anything except getting up tomorrow morning and going back through the same process? And he is successful. He's a successful merchant. He is dealing with native people. He comes to know a number of people whose lives he becomes very much involved with within that community. But at the same time, you know, the end bottom line is never clear. He's searching for something. He never quite finds it in the novel.
Is this character significant, Paul, because he represents what's going on with a lot of people, a lot of countries, individuals, politically and socially today?
Oh, I think so. And again, in my own experience, having spent a year in Africa, in sub-Sahara Africa, Black Africa, I was continually running into people of this kind.
People without countries, people without deep cultural roots, is that it?
People who in some ways were sort of the human remnants of old empires.
Uh-huh.
Here is an Indian man who has come to a country in East Africa when it was part of the British colonial system. He came, you know, because basically he was part of a larger system and a good merchant could do well there and would constantly be a Britisher and part of that broader kind of circumstance. Now the empire is gone. He is left there. He must again evolve a certain kind of persona in connection with a new set of circumstances. He can't go back. He doesn't have roots. The empire is not present. So then he's thrown more or less upon his own resources as to, you know, what he does in order to try to find some sort of meaning within life.
Well, how successful is he at this?
It's in many respects, there's a great tension within the novel. There's one episode which maybe would help to illustrate the point I'm trying to make here. The leading character, Salim, continually says in the earlier part of the novel that in terms of sort of viewing what ultimate values he would like to eventually attain within his life, he is tremendously influenced by European culture and Western civilization. And someday, when he is saved enough money, someday when he has been able to be sufficiently successful to do so, he will go to Europe and he will become then a part of a meaningful and advanced and exciting culture, which is the sort of thing he aspires to. He recognizes this will not be his culture, but it will be certainly a different culture. It will be what he has read about for years. It will be something that he feels is tremendously important. And so he eventually winds up in London and spends some time in London and suddenly begins to find that this advanced culture, which he has so fantasized about and worshipped for so many years, has no place for him either. As a matter of fact, in terms of his life, he has far more identity as a small shopkeeper in an African village where he is respected and where he is useful and where he has a role which serves a purpose than he would ever be, let's say, as a small Indian shopkeeper in London, where he would be totally expendable, a second-class citizen, and have no role, no meaning, no function, no purpose whatsoever. So he eventually goes back after this disappointing trip to his village, only to find that the village has been taken over by the African chief, the big man, who is a sort of a prototype of Idi Amin, and he is suddenly left, again, homeless in between worlds and no longer with roots. And the novel closes upon a scene of his leaving the village sort of under fire on a ship going downriver, having no idea where ultimately he will wind up.
Who should read such a book as this?
Everyone. I think the fact that the Nobel Prize this year for peace was given to the United Nations International Refugee Committee says something about a whole group of people who are very much a part of our times, whether they are Cambodians who are fleeing from there or whether they are people fleeing from Eastern Europe. In many respects, these people have a certain kind of commonality in their lifestyles. They can never go back. They will never be a part of something new. They have to deal with their own kind of indeterminate, intermediate status and come to terms with themselves on these grounds.
It sounds, Paul, as though Naipaul in A Bend in the River is writing a book about a world of refugees and particularly people who may not recognize themselves
as refugees. Right. Yes, I think it's a superb point, and I kept continually identifying in this novel, not simply with Africa, which I loved and enjoyed and came to get have a great kind of empathy for, but with modern society. I mean, the young person who leaves the farm and goes to the strange, hostile, unfamiliar city and can really never go back, and at the same time will never be fully assimilated into an urban life because of his or her own roots and background, et cetera, et cetera. Caught some way again in between and having then to make some kind of accommodations between what he once was, what he can never really fully hope to be, and still accommodations which will let him or her have a fruitful life in a contemporary society.
So V.S. Naipaul is employing old themes in the service of new lessons.
In many ways, and doing so with a kind of subtlety which is both very low-key and at the same time just totally engrossing. I mean, it's very difficult once you get into this novel not to want to follow through and see how this plays out, how it ultimately sort of ends.
Paul Murphy is a scholar at the National Humanities Center who's lived and traveled in East Africa, the setting for V.S. Naipaul's 1979 novel, A Bend in the River. Professor Murphy teaches at the University of Minnesota. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with Soundings. With the death of Professor Hugh Holman in October 1981, the center has lost a devoted friend and steadfast supporter. Hugh Holman was instrumental in the establishment and success of the National Humanities Center, where he served as vice president, vice chairman of its board of trustees, and a member of its executive committee. As a Keenan Professor of English at the University of North Carolina, Hugh Holman enjoyed the admiration of his students and colleagues for his scholarship and critical abilities. He was a distinguished scholar of the American novel, the literature of the South, and particularly of the novelist Thomas Wolfe. The Handbook to Literature, edited by Professor Holman, was the best of its kind. But students and friends also found in Hugh Holman a trustworthy counselor of even temper, great patience, astonishing clarity of judgment, and quiet encouragement. Hugh Holman possessed a sure sense of himself, of what's possible, and how best to connect the two. In that regard, his generous example extended well beyond academic matters. He was a man in whom one always found someone at home. To those around him, Hugh Holman was an inspiring teacher and gracious friend. One of those, in Stephen Spender's words, who in their lives fought for life, who wore at their hearts the fire's center. Born of the sun, they traveled a short while towards the sun and left the vivid air signed with their honor. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me this week for Soundings, conversations about the literature of myth and adventure, digging up the past on a Turkish archaeological expedition, a review of a critically acclaimed novel about Africa, those reports and more this week on Soundings.